Welcome into the Ether, a podcast focusing on all things Ethereum, the leading blockchain for decentralized applications. I'm Eric Connor, your host and founder of ETHub, a decentralized information hub for Ethereum. Into the Ether features deep dives on topics with prominent guests in the community, as well as ETHub weekly recaps featuring Anthony Sisano. Hello, everyone, and welcome into the Ether. Today, I have Jacob Franek and Antoine Lecave from Coinmetrics on the podcast. Coinmetrics is a provider of crypto asset market and network data and is the top site I always use when looking at crypto data. Thanks for joining, Jacob and Antoine.
Thanks, Eric. Happy to be here.
Yep, thanks. Thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, looking forward to discussion. I'm a big fan of your site, so this should be fun to talk about. Kind of before we dive into Coinmetrics and the site and everything that you guys are building, can you just kind of tell me about yourselves and how you both got involved in crypto?
Sure, maybe I can kick things off. It's always an interesting story. So I'm Jacob Franek. I'm the Chief Operating Officer. I actually come from a different field, which is kind of bioinformatics, but you know, I'll get more into my crypto story. So I actually entered into crypto through poker. I used to play quite a bit when I was in college. It was kind of a part-time job of mine. And at one point, I think PokerStars and a number of other large sites got banned in the US. There was a huge crackdown. A lot of people lost a lot of money. And I was living in Canada at the time. And once that happened, it became really difficult to deposit money onto poker sites, whether using a credit card or wire or whatever. You actually had to, you know, deposit into these shady Cayman Island PayPal-like intermediaries. And then even though poker technically wasn't illegal, it just became really difficult to deposit. And so I moved to the U.S. at some point in 2014. And in 2015, 2016, I wanted to start playing, you know, poker just for fun again, and didn't want to have to deal with the headache of trying to go through multiple credit cards or, you know, these weird intermediaries. And I noticed at the time that one of the large US-based poker sites actually started accepting Bitcoin. And so I started buying Bitcoin simply to deposit and, you know, play poker kind of for fun and recreationally. And so I kind of went down the rabbit hole in two different phases. One was trying to find ways to buy Bitcoin. You know, I was looking at ATMs and then realized like, wow, those are really expensive in terms of the fees and the exchange rate doesn't seem to be great. You know, I saw Coinbase. I ended up actually using this peer-to-peer one. It wasn't local Bitcoins, but I'm blanking on the name at the moment, but started buying Bitcoin. And then through that process, I also became aware of Ethereum and Ether and started going down the rabbit hole and you know, learned more about just blockchains and Bitcoin and Ethereum in general. And then the concept of kind of programmable money kind of hit me, and you know, that was it for me. So went down the rabbit hole and spent 4 hours a day every day for the last, you know, four years.
Yeah, my story is kind of similar. I was still a student, so my background is, compared to Jacob, is purely crypto. I was still a student when I first heard of it. And at the time, buying some was quite tricky compared to now. So I looked at many options. I ended up buying up some in peer-to-peer exchanges. And after I bought some, of course, it crashed, as it always happens. And I started going deeper into the technical ends of it. I was studying computer science with a focus on data mining and data analysis. And then I realized that, wait, I have a financial network worth some money where everything is open. It's not transparent, fully transparent. You don't know who is transacting, but you have access to all these transactions. And at the time, I was working on analyzing networks. So for example, patents that cite one another, they form a network, social networks, and Bitcoin forms one as well. But when an address pays another one and it pays another one, it creates a network. So I started cobbling up some code to trying to analyze it. And it started a long, long path towards analyzing all the blockchains at that time. So mid-2014, I created PeterSage.info, which became, in the end, the repository of all the Bitcoin statistics that I find interesting that I've collected over the years. I finished my studies, I got an internship at blockchain.info, which still is and was the largest Bitcoin wallet company in the world, or at least non-custodial. And after that, I joined Coinmetrics when I heard of Nick Carter. So what they were doing, what CoinMetrics was doing, and I felt it was the next step up the ladder into analyzing all these blockchains, getting data out of them, because it is basically what is driving me is getting curious about some aspect of a currency of Bitcoin or Ethereum or any other one and trying to go to the bottom of it through data analysis and crunching it.
Nice. That's great. Yeah. I always like to hear everyone's background. I love starting with that question because everybody's unique and, you know, somehow got into it in a different way. So it's always cool to talk about, I think. I kind of want to transition now into CoinMetrics and kind of the products that you guys are offering. So can you kind of, you know, for people that haven't heard of CoinMetrics, I'm sure a lot of people have, and I'm guessing most of my listeners have used your community data and the graphs that you have on your site. But for people listening that aren't aware, can you kind of describe exactly what CoinMetrics is, what products you guys offer, and then also if you wouldn't mind just kind of giving a brief history and kind of like what the team looks like today?
Yeah, sure. So CoinMetrics is a crypto asset data provider, and commercially we position ourselves as an all-in-one crypto financial data solution for institutions. And what that means is that we're building or have built structured data products across what we see as the four verticals or pillars of crypto asset data. So that's, you know, on-chain or network data, that's market or exchange data, that's alternative data, which then includes things like sentiment or developer activity. And then indexes is kind of, overlaps all four of those. And so, you know, we're building structured data products for institutions who are trying to use that data across different functions, and that can include things like trade execution, asset management, custody, or research. And so, you know, we're not just kind of a raw data company. We're taking data, whether it's from exchanges or whether it's from blockchains, and structuring it and kind of building it for particular use cases. And so that's kind of commercially where we're focused. But then we have a community data product that's focused on network data that goes back to kind of the roots of how CoinMetrics started, and I can get back into that in a moment. But that's kind of free and open to the community. We also have an academic sponsorship program where we provide all of our, any or all of our data for free to academic individuals and institutions that are doing peer review research on crypto networks. And then we have a few other initiatives that, underway that we, we're passionate about kind of supporting the community and the growth and the global adoption and education around crypto and its data. And so, you know, we see that as kind of an important part of our mission. And then finally, kind of underpinning all of that is the research and kind of engagement that we do. So we have a weekly newsletter, for example. We also work very closely with our clients to engage on the data, particularly on the network data side, because it is so new and kind of interesting. And how you use it, how you interpret it, is kind of very much a novel science and somewhat an art. And so we spend a lot of time engaging with clients, thinking about it, doing our own research, and so we don't see ourselves just as a data company or just as an API company. That's why we kind of pitch ourselves as an entire solution. And I can jump more into the history. So, CoinMetrics started in 2017 as an open source project. So Nick Carter, he says hi, by the way, and Alexei Nokrin, who's our CTO, started this project as a way to, use the ledgers, use the actual blockchain networks themselves as a source of truth, and also to understand the economic significance and usage of different crypto networks. And, because at the time there was a lot of, it was 2017, a lot of networks were launching. It's hard to tell which ones have real usage, which ones potentially have economic value. Is that, which ones have actual economic, significance? And so the thesis at the time was that, network or on-chain data could help inform that. And then we professionalized in Q3 of 2018. That generated quite a bit of buzz, and it became clear that this data and information was useful. We professionalized in Q3 of 2018. We raised seed. Nick's fund, Castle Island Ventures, actually led the round. So Nick went on to launch a fund, and Fidelity and a few others joined to kind of join us in this journey along not only network data, but it became clear that other elements of data were necessary, both for the public and for institutions to kind of get into crypto. Good data is a core component of the infrastructure for global adoption and understanding. And so we see ourselves as kind of being important in that.
Nice. Yeah. So you've mentioned now, you know, you kind of have the community data, which is what I've personally used, and it's kind of out there on your site for free. And then you have your private institutional data, which are obviously two different user groups. And I know you just recently announced kind of an upgrade to the community data. And I know there were kind of an overhaul to the data, maybe some cleaning up and just getting better metrics there and all kinds of stuff. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you guys changed?
Sure. So, you know, because CoinMetrics started as kind of a GarageBand project, you know, it was an open source project that was supported simply by contributions from the community. Most of the network data infrastructure was, you know, built from kind of the ground up and built on, you know, on a shoestring budget. And so when we professionalized and raised seed, we really started building, you know, professional institutional grade infrastructure that ended up being on different systems and different servers, different, you know, more powerful machines and so on. And, you know, at some point we became, you know, we were essentially juggling two different systems and it didn't make a lot of sense because the data overlapped and so on. And, you know, when we professionalized, it was always kind of our vision to continue to grow and support our community and the community data. But, you know, in order to have the funding and the infrastructure to do that, you know, we needed to professionalize. And so what we launched, I think, yesterday was essentially the transition of all of our kind of legacy data on the network data side that's open to the community. All of that infrastructure got shifted to our pro infrastructure. And with that, was a number of different upgrades. Now, I won't get into all of them, but we added some assets. We revised some kind of metric calculations. It's all running now on our professional API. We launched a kind of clear set of definitions, a data dictionary. We'll be launching some additional tools that allow people to kind of look into the data and so on. And so, you know, we continue to grow and support that. And you know, as I said, we see that as an important kind of mission of ours.
Nice. That's great. Yeah, I was already playing around with the updates and everything looks good. I noticed some of the kind of metrics had changed a tiny bit. And so I'm sure just the data quality is getting better, which is good to see. You know, and when I'm looking at data personally, there's a couple of reasons I look at Ethereum data. I would say the first is probably around, well, I'm mostly obsessed with the monetary policy side of things and the economics. So I'm looking a lot like at block rewards and how much fees are being paid on the network. But I like to look at network health. So things like transactions per day and, you know, the uncle rate and stuff like that. But, you know, I think a lot of people also use data to kind of understand where price should be or where they think price should be relative to some of the on-chain metrics and usage metrics we're seeing. So, you know, I think it's, you know, just having raw data doesn't present that story. And one thing I've always liked of CoinMetrics is you guys have kind of developed some of your own metrics specifically to on your site that are unique. Like you wouldn't just be able to pull it yourself from raw data. So can you kind of talk about some of those metrics and that you guys have developed specifically?
Yeah, so one of the big metric that you can't find elsewhere, and I think which is critically important, is the adjusted transaction volume. So on crypto assets, anyone can transact, and depending on the fee policy of the asset and also game ability, the raw volume figures of how many Bitcoins or Ether or Dogecoin were transacted in a given day are kind of hard to make sense of. There are, of course, an upper bound on what actually happened, but if you want to go down to what actually happened and removing some activity that you might find which is not economical activity, then you need to develop some adjustments. So one of the first companies to do it was Blockchain on Info, but we've taken a step beyond and implemented heuristics to clean out the volume to make it closer to what the ground truth is, which, by the way, no one is going to be able to know what is the ground truth of how many Bitcoins or Ethereum are transacted in a meaningful way. One, because no one has this data set, and two, because the meaningfulness depends on the people. So we've decided to create a set of heuristics which would tailor to the broadest audience. And they try to remove activity from coins that move very quickly. One pattern that is present in Ethereum and in Bitcoin is I send money to an exchange and then the exchange use my money to pay a withdrawal immediately. Or they use the money to move it into another wallet. And this movement is not really economical. What was the intention is I deposit one Bitcoin in an exchange, but what is end up happening on chain is one Bitcoin, two Bitcoin, three Bitcoin moved, or there was a transaction that totaled up to three Bitcoins. Another example right now is you have Binance, which is creating transactions to withdraw from their cold wallet to their hot wallet. by doing so, they create, you know, when they want to credit the hot wallet with 2,000 Bitcoins, they move 400,000 Bitcoins, which if you just look at the numbers, you might think, oh, wow, there's a lot of activity on Bitcoin right now. But in the end, if you use a set of heuristics to clean it up, you see that the intent was only to move 2,000 Bitcoins. So that's one of the important heuristics is transaction volume. It helps you understand how much, not real, but at least non-noisy activity is happening on chain. Another one, which is more on the supply side, is the realized gap, which we offer on the community side for Bitcoin and other UTXO asset, and on the pro side for all the assets that we can. And the realized gap is a more, basically, when transaction volume can be clean, we try to clean the market cap. For example, Satoshi's coins have been created in 2009, but they've never been moved since. And so far, we don't know if they're ever going to move. So why would you value them at the current price when you can decide to discount them? And the realized cap tries to do that. Many people understand it in many different ways, and there's different ways to look at it. The base idea is instead of valuing all the supply of a coin at the current market price, you value each individual part of the supply at the time it was last moved or activated or spent. So for example, if I have coins that have never moved since 2011, they would not be valued at the current price, they would be valued at the price in 2011. And this gives you a much smoother market cap, and it also has some interesting properties. For example, when the realized gap is below the market price, it gives us some indication that the people owning this asset are in having paper gains. When it is below, and when it is above the market cap, it means that people are having losses. They bought coins at 100 and now it's worth 50. That's one of the adjustments. We have other, many other ones. Those are the biggest ones, for example, active supply. You know, for example, how many Ethereum there is, but it's also interesting to know how many have been used in any way in the last year or in the last week or in the last 2 years. For example, I think last time I checked, there's 7 million Ether that were created in the genesis of Ethereum that still haven't moved. So that's a lot of coins that you might see on a ledger, but they're not really any economical activity. And we try to come up with new adjustments for all the metrics that we can. And it's something we might want to chat about later is the gameability of all these metrics. Transaction count, for example, is a big one. When it doesn't cost a lot to do transactions, anyone that is interested or has a position in the asset might want to create a lot of transactions to make it seem like there's a lot of activity. And our job is to be the other side to say, wait a second, there might be 50 million, well, let's begin about 50 million transactions, but how many of them are not legitimate, but, you know, have some value attached to them or are between various people? There's active addresses as well, which can be gamed. And basically, our adjustments are trying to remove the gameability to say that the value of a metric should be linked to some work, like proof of work. So the difficulty is one transaction, one metric you cannot game because, I mean, you need a lot of hash power to do it. So we want to do the same for all the types of metrics. So market cap, active addresses, transaction count. Yeah, so not all these adjustments are coin metrics exclusive in the ID, but at least the way we implement them and the way we try them to make it so that they apply to all the assets in a relatively similar, I think, makes us stand apart from other companies or individuals or processes.
And just to build on top of that, I mean, Antoine touched on this, but the fundamental concept is trying to create, you know, metrics and methods for allowing greater comparability across the, you know, different crypto networks. And so different crypto networks differ both in their accounting models. You know, some are UTXO based, some are account based like Ethereum. You know, Bitcoin is UTXO based. And then they also differ in certain, you know, economic parameters. So EOS, for example, doesn't charge a transaction level fee, but the fees are kind of born somewhere else in the system. And if you just take the raw data and you don't, you know, asterisk or consider those kind of differences, then you're bound to get, you know, probably wrong conclusions when you compare some of this on-chain data. Now, if you start to adjust that data and try to smooth out some of those differences, then you get a better picture. But ultimately, you have to have, you know, you always have to keep these caveats in mind. You know, you can't, a UTXO chain is never going to be perfectly comparable to an account-based chain, for example. And, you know, a chain like EOS that has a very different economic structure is never going to be perfectly comparable to one that, you know, that does charge transaction level fees. It's kind of like, you know, traders who, you know this quite well, those who trade on exchanges that don't have fees per, for each trade, and those that do have fees, you know, those that don't have fees, you're more worried about whether that volume is real or not. And so it's a similar concept with blockchains.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's something I've tweeted about a lot in the past and thought about a lot too, is it's very hard to compare across chains, right? And you guys have touched on all the reasons, but, you know, even the most basic example, like transactions per day, transactions are very different in Bitcoin and Ethereum to me, right? Like on Ethereum, to me, gas used is a bit more important than transactions. And once you get into like an EOS that doesn't charge fees, those can be spammed in game. So to me, it's very hard to compare across chains. And I guess we're almost talking about like intra-chain data versus inter-chain data, which is interesting as well. I pretty much myself just worry about intra-chain data on Ethereum. I've kind of given up a bit on comparing across chains just because every chain's unique, right? And it's kind of tough to do. I think the one that people are still kind of obsessed with to compare across chains is market cap, which, you know, I'm not a huge fan of that either for comparing interchain. Do each of you kind of have a favorite metric? Like if you could pick one, what do you think is the best way to kind of compare value across all these different chains?
So I've got one that I've called the pessimistic cap. So it's a mix basically between the market cap and the realized cap. So the base idea is that the realized cap is good at undervaluing assets. So for example, during the Bitcoin run-up of 2017, if people didn't cash in their coins, but the price was still going up, it was showing Bitcoin as slightly undervalued. But it has another default, realized cap has another default, is that for assets that are very illiquid and or where a large source of the supply are held by a small number of people, it tends to overvalue the assets. If you take, for example, Stellar, there's 100 billion Stellar outstanding, but there's only 16 billion, last I remember, that are actually circulating. So whenever the Stellar Foundation moves their coin, we value them at the current price, even though it was just a wallet upgrade. That's, you know, 2 billion lumens times, I don't know what the price is, that's a lot of money. So the pessimistic cap is you just take the minimum of the two. You just are the most pessimistic about the value of the asset. If the market cap is above the realized cap, then you pick the smallest estimate, which is the realized cap and the inverse. And it gives you basically the smallest estimate of the value of the asset. It isn't always the right, but I think it's a close estimate to what the asset is really worth, at least at the time of where they compute the data. It doesn't tell you anything about the future worth of the asset, but I find it interesting.
Yeah, it's a great example. And I mean, it's a really complicated question, actually, to come up with a single metric that serves a particular use case. I mean, you kind of have to ask what use case are you trying to solve? You know, market cap is a good indicator of the market's value of the network or of the assets that are behind the network. But it becomes problematic when you have smaller chains or smaller assets, you know, that are more liquid, that only trade on a few venues, where the supply is held by, you know, a large proportion of the supply is held by founders. You know, you get into the kind of issues that apply to any market, not just the crypto market for smaller assets, you know, like penny stocks and so on. So it's hard to find a single metric that kind of serves that purpose. What we do think quite a lot about are some of the on-chain data that you can use to compare within a particular class. And so something like miner revenue, which is the, you know, the total amount of fees and the value of the coins issued, you know, from the inflation or monetary policy, you know, all of that goes to miners, and the revenue that they earn is pretty hard to game. I mean, that's technically, you know, unless the founders of the network are the same people, you know, that are doing the validation, particularly for the public chains. I mean, that's a value that is fairly economical. And if you have a large distributed mining base, you know that value is being spread out. And so you can compare different proof of work networks, for example, and particularly the more public public ones on metrics like miner revenue, which gives you a slightly different take than market cap. So we think a lot about that. I mean, there's other network metrics that you can look at, but you have to be a little bit careful. Again, comparing, applying that same measure equally across every single chain, because there are so many chains that have a large proportion of the supply held by founders, that can do things that, maybe would game some of these metrics.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've talked about gameability a few times so far, so I want to dive into that a little deeper. How does your team kind of, value soft data and research around this relative to quantitative metrics? And do you think the importance of one or the other will change over time? So I guess, how do you account for gameability if you see it in the data?
So actually, we start from the assumption that if a metric exists or there's a way to do something, people will game it anyway, because in the end, that's what ends up happening. So we try to provide the raw transaction or metrics, for example, how many transactions, but we'll always try to come up with an adjustment or a broader view. So you picked before the example of Ethereum transactions and Bitcoin transactions. They are not the same, as you mentioned. It always annoys me when someone compares them, but we created a higher level abstraction, which is what we call transfers, how many times a unit of currency changed hands. And this is, it's not perfectly comparable because there's still some nuances about account base and UTXO, but it is much closer to the actual truth of what is happening on chain. So the way we tackle gameability is by making all the metrics that you can game have a cost associated with them. So mining revenue, it's kind of hard to game. You get, because every unit of money you earn, you have to get someone to buy it, because mining is a close to zero sum game. A realized cap, you have to hold a lot of supply to have a disproportionate influence on it. And for all these metrics that we can, we try to attach a cost, which is at least proportional to the value to game it. So if you want to double the metric, you have to spend twice the money that the network is doing at the current time. And when we see it, unless we can pin it down to like something or someone, and even then it's kind of hard to prove like, something is happening. And even then it's not really obviously a bad thing. One example is Variblock. So Variblock is a protocol that uses proof of proof, whatever that is. And they run a test on a Bitcoin mainnet. So basically at some point, quite a large chunks of the Bitcoin transactions were Variblock miners just publishing upbeat transactions. So some people might see it as uneconomical activity or non-Bitcoin related, which is a point of view, but we assess that it didn't impact that much a lot of metrics. It didn't impact active addresses. It only had an impact on transaction count. So there was no need for an adjustment just for this particular actor. And people would say, like someone's spam or someone's game activity is another people's legitimate activity. So it's kind of hard to pin it down. We're just trying to approach gameability from just moving the things on a higher plane kind of thing, where we take the base metrics that are trivially gameable and we create new ones, which you can still game, but it will cost you something. So it removes the incentive to do it, or at least it makes it much more expensive.
Yeah, and adding to that, if it comes from a methodological perspective, it's kind of, again, goes back to like, what kind of questions are you trying to answer with this data, right? Because how you treat the data and how you view the gameability of it kind of depends on, in some part, on the question. But as you can see, just from, Antoine's kind of discussion of this, like it becomes a very qualitative exercise. Like no matter what question you're answering, it's hard to come up with a single metric that's going to answer it. And so you have to create, mental models or frameworks or ways of qualitatively taking all these different pieces of evidence and, using that to form an opinion or to draw some kind of a picture to get towards, a solution. And you can do that, unstructuredly, or you can do that structuredly, using a structured or kind of formal process where you quite literally, attach weights or, other kind of ways of ranking certain pieces of information. But it does become a very qualitative exercise. Now you can approach it quantitatively. You can start to get into multi-factor modeling. And again, it depends on the use case, but you can create, multi-factor scores that take multiple different metrics into consideration and weight them, apply some kind of a statistical aggregation method, and some kind of a weighting scheme. But as you get into that, complexity starts to grow more and more. And to an end user, somebody who's trying to then interpret that, it becomes a lot harder if you're creating some kind of a metric that has 10 different factors going into it that are weighted, and those weightings have different assumptions to them, and you might have to justify the assumptions and so on. And so regardless of whether you try to approach things qualitatively or quantitatively, you really end up going through a quantitative or through a qualitative exercise. And so you need to have some understanding, you need to provide some context, and you need to provide some interpretation. And that's where not just having the data, but having an understanding of what it means and the differences and what you're trying to achieve with a certain goal become really important. So, I don't think we're ever going to get out of the need for soft research in crypto. And in particular, because we think that a lot of this network data is very interesting, kind of, and aligns somewhat with like global macroeconomic data. A lot of it is almost like being, looking at the M1 supply, the M1 money supply of Bitcoin or of Ether. And some of our metrics, we think, and when we, work with clients, we kind of explain how some of these metrics map to certain macroeconomic concepts. And I mean, it's quite loose. It's not perfect. And cryptos themselves, like Bitcoin and Ethereum, are not exactly monies. They're kind of commodity monies. So they behave a bit like commodities and they behave a bit like monies. And so, none of these existing kind of legacy market concepts are going to apply perfectly. But because of the complexity here and because, there's no one factor that you can use to kind of answer a question, you're always going to need to have, skill and soft research to help interpret some of these data.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I want to dive into the Ethereum side of data here in a second, but one more general question. There's a lot of hot debate about how to measure blockchain usage. So, is it daily active users? Is it money locked in DeFi? And it's very hard to measure across chains, of course. And I say all the time, the Ethereum network's full as far as like its gas capacity on a daily basis. So it's tough right now for Ethereum to grow on the daily active user side. But what do you guys think are the right metrics for measuring usage on a blockchain or blockchain applications?
For me, where you have to approach it into different categories. So for example, how big is the network? So what's the market cap or the realized cap or the outstanding supply? Then you have to look at the user base. So how many addresses? So you can never know how many people, but how many addresses own any of this currency, or how many own more than $10 worth or $1,000 worth? And how did it look over time? Did it was a gradual growth, or which, for example, a pattern present for a lot of ICOs? ICO opens, 10,000 people buy in, and then it's just a low trickle down to whatever it is currently. You have to also like the on-chain activity. How many transactions are happening per day? Something we look into creating is how many transactions above certain thresholds in dollar value or in native units value. Because if you have, like in yours, I imagine, millions of transactions, but how many transactions were for more than $1,000 worth of tokens? You have also supply health, like how many for it's actually very interesting for forks, like how many coins were last moved in 1 year, because it gives you, for at a fork time, there might be the same amount of units that were moved in the last year, but 1 year afterwards, for example, Bitcoin Gold has no activity, but Bitcoin has a lot more activity. Look, then we can go into more specifics, because these metrics so far are broadly applicable across all assets. But for specific assets, you have to dig a bit deeper. So for example, Ethereum would be, as you mentioned, money locked in DeFi. Maybe look at how many unique contracts are deployed, or contract activity compared to transactional activity, to mining activity. For Bitcoin, you would look at things like Lightning Network, uptake of SegWit, maybe the Liquid sidechain, which is still very small but could grow one day. Or you would look at non-monetary uses of Bitcoin, like Ferriblock or Open Timestamps, which is small but could grow one day. So it's a quite complex thing to apprehend. It's because blockchain usage is kind of easy to say, but it's very hard to quantify if it is even possible. I think you have to just look at the data, look also at soft data, like how many people talk about Bitcoin, Ethereum, or Dentacoin. Nobody talks about Dentacoin, but its market cap is quite high. So it's complicated. I don't think there's any one silver bullet to encompass all the ways you could look at blockchain activity. But we try to provide all the tools to do it.
Yeah, it goes a little bit back to the conversation we were just having about, like, you know, are there single metrics that you can value, I mean, or that you can use to answer certain questions? And again, it depends on the question. It depends on what metrics you have at hand. And I think you and I are a little bit aligned, you know, in the sense of that value lockup is an important concept, both at the application level and also overall for a chain, because in Ethereum's case, it speaks a little bit to its utility as a money. But if you take a step back and just, you know, ask, like, how would you measure whether a money, you know, just a regular fiat currency is doing, it has a lot of activity, right? And what does that mean? Because a lot of small transactions has a lot of utility and probably create social good, but very large transactions can also at a low cost and you know, doing that in a censorship and kind of censorship resistant and permissionless way also has value, right? And so how do you quantify that value and say that, you know, one is more important than the other? And I think we do get a little bit caught up in the kind of Silicon Valley, you know, monthly active users, daily clicks, daily active users kind of concept. I mean, I think that might make sense a little bit for applications, but, you know, those applications where we traditionally measure that aren't, you know, we're not measuring the value that's moving across those networks, right? And you're just, you know, measuring clicks or opens of a particular application. Once you get more into value transfer, then, you know, I really do think you need to start getting into different concepts. And it's not just about how many transactions move, which of course is a in itself and, you know, sign of adoption and so on. But, you know, for that one person who's moving a large amount of value, that could be providing them a huge amount of utility. And just because others aren't doing it, it doesn't mean that that network or that application or, you know, that blockchain doesn't have, you know, doesn't have value. So it is a complicated question and it is fairly nuanced. And it goes back to just, you know, what's the question and how do you, what kind of groups of metrics and the interactions between those group of metrics, what does that say, you know, to help you answer those kind of questions?
And without getting all philosophical, there's even other aspects that blockchain data will never be able to encompass, but it's still interesting to think about, like, how many people would accept to work 1 hour and be paid in the currency? That's a good indicator of how useful it is. I mean, I wouldn't work to be paid in North Korean currency, but dollars, maybe, euro, yes. Bitcoin, surely. So it gives you an indication of how many merchants use it daily, how many people are paid in that currency. These are things that I think not a lot of people think about because we were all close to the chain and looking at the on-chain activity, but it is something that if you really want to know how useful a commodity or currency is, it is something you have to look into. Coinmetrics, I mean, you're not doing that right now, but it would be interesting to find ways to try to estimate these kind of signals.
Yeah, just to build on that, I think Antoine was touching on this, but now we're getting more into kind of monetary theory of, you know, so an asset like BTC or like ETH, but you look at, you know, medium of exchange, store of value, unit of account, and so on. But there's other concepts like standard of deferred payment, for example, where you get into kind of deeper concepts of a money that I think apply here and kind of speak to what Antoine was getting at.
Yeah, definitely. And like you said, there's no silver bullet. I think everyone kind of has their favorite metrics, right? Like I look a lot at active addresses versus price across Bitcoin and Ether. I look at a lot of stuff. And it's interesting how it'll evolve over time too, right? Like as we see layer two solutions come on board and on the Ethereum side sharding, that's going to increase the capacity of the network. I think then it'll be a little bit more valuable to look at daily active users versus locked up money in DeFi. So this stuff all evolves. And one of the things I've always liked about Coinmetrics, like we talked about earlier, is you guys build, you know, your own unique metrics to help look at this, which is cool. I want to shift a little bit into the Ethereum side of things and talk quickly about some Ethereum specific data. Just what are some interesting things you're noticing when observing the Ethereum network or Ethereum data over the past few years, you know, let's say from launch till now and how things have evolved? And it can be either bullish or bearish, but what's just something interesting that stood out to you?
Yeah, so at least on the network data analysis side, the main defining event of Ethereum, just because it makes things much more complicated, was the DAO attacks after the fork. So when we first tried to analyze Ethereum in a deep way, so you have to basically track everything that happened ever on chain, and the times where there was the most activity on chain, and you can see it in the active addresses chart, was in October 2016 after the fork. So this is purely on the network data analysis side. It's quite challenging to be able to ingest all of that. Something we run into when you want to synchronize, for example, an archive node or even a full node, you will see it slowed down significantly at that period of time. But outside of that, I mean, interesting things is just how big the mining was back in the day. So Ethereum doesn't have batched payments. So if I'm a mining pool and I get, 1,000 Ether and I get to distribute out to 10 miners, I have to make 10 transactions. And this was quite a significant check of the early activity of Ethereum. And it surprised me when I saw how large it was. But it does make sense. It's the same for all the proof of work assets in 2015, 2016. Most of the activity is mining. Then you can see the diversification of Ethereum into more contracts. If you look at the layer 2 solutions, well, not layer 2, but tokens like ESC20 is happening. It is quite interesting. Something also, still related to Ethereum, is the sheer number of tokens that live on it and the difficulties of analyzing all of them in a deep way. So there was the ESC20 standard, but unfortunately, it's more of a recommendation than a standard, and each token had a different way to handle it. So in the end, it's still manageable, but for example, minting tokens, some created a mint event, some have an event that is the all zero address sends money to the issuer, or some just baked in a contract that I could give myself all the money at the beginning of the asset history. So it is interesting. And now we're getting into even more complex assets, like for example, DAI and Maker, which got basic, not basic metrics, a full set of metrics on those assets, but going deeper into how everything worked, the CDPs, and providing data on that would make DAI and Maker, I think, one of the most complex assets that we have to handle. And then going forward, Ethereum 2.0 is going to be even more complex. So the trend I've seen happening is more and more complexity. It is normal when you try to express complicated things the goal of Ethereum is to be able to express anything on EVM. Then, of course, you get into complicated analysis. But at the end, it's also what makes it interesting when you have an asset that you can fully understand and fully comprehend in one click. And because there's no complex activity on it, it's less interesting than one that has, complex activity which you could assimilate to some life happening.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, on that point, there's a site out there called Curious Giraffe, I believe it's called, and they do data analysis on specific applications. So you can dive into Compound, you can dive into Maker. Has your team thought at all about kind of going one layer deeper, say, on the Ethereum chain and analyzing dApp-specific data?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, Antoine kind of touched on it. Our approach at the moment is focused mostly on creating a pretty deep and rich data set, but that's broadly applicable across most of the base chain assets. That alone is quite an undertaking because of the complexities of different chains and the depth at which we kind of, try to think about this stuff. But, as Antoine pointed out, you could have an entire application an entire data product built just around CDP data, right? Just around Maker. You could have an entire product built probably just around that. And the more that these larger, stepping back a little bit, you could have a product just built around DeFi. And those are definitely things that we want to do. For us, it's kind of there's a constant balance between depth and breadth. So do you add more assets or do you start going deeper in a particular asset? And, we're up to about 70 assets now on the pro side, not at the same level of depth for all of those. But, once you get beyond the top 20 to 30 or so assets, from just an investability perspective and from an institutional kind of interest perspective, there's just not enough liquidity there. And there starts to be a lot of question marks around some of those assets. Some of the assets have huge founder supplies. Or, you know, once you get past the top 30 to 50, it's a lot of them are just ERC-20 tokens built on top of Ethereum. And so for us, as we, you know, as we've, the limit that we've reached right now in terms of breadth, at this point, it's time to, for us probably to start shifting and focusing deeper and deeper on depth. And, you know, Antoine mentioned p2sh.info, a site that he runs, which goes kind of deep into Bitcoin scripts and a lot of deep Bitcoin data. And so for us, it just makes sense to go deeper and deeper into the top, you know, into the top assets. Some of that will be driven by our own kind of curiosity and what we think is interesting and where we think there will be interest. And then others will probably just be driven by client demand. You know, if there are specific things that we see that a lot of people are asking for, whether it's DeFi products and or on market data side, things like derivatives and, you know, futures and options and stuff like that, we'll start to add those. So it's part exploration and part just seeing where the market is and what kind of demand there is for that.
Yeah, there's also something which, whenever you add a metric, you have to explain it to people and clients. And it's already hard enough to explain all the intricacies, because there's, even just from with like transfer volume, there's a lot of intricacies depending on certain assets and certain things. So the deeper you go, the more explaining you have to do. What is a CDP? How it works? So I think we have to maybe wait a bit for the investor base to mature and be able to ingest all this data, because just the base, I mean, not the base, but the existing pro data is set is quite intensive to ingest, and even we get some type code into the intricacies of the asset and we forget that this asset does this a different way and we forgot to account for it. So going deeper is extremely interesting, but there's always a cost associated with it, which is you have to be able to find people that will understand all the value that you're trying to provide. And I think we'll get there eventually. It's just a question of who's going to be on the other side.
Yeah, and what's the value of going to that depth, right? It's not always clear whether that information is actionable or useful in a particular way. And so, you know, we could go as deep as we want, but to Antoine's point, unless there's a use case or unless it's clear what that data can be used for, then it's an interesting exploration. It's really interesting and kind of academically and just from a curiosity perspective, but from a product perspective, it becomes a little bit, you know, questionable. And so we always have to kind of balance that as well. And I mean, that's why we are a structured data company. You know, we're not just providing access to raw data. We spend a lot of time thinking about these metrics and what would they actually be used for. And that, you know, that applies both from the research perspective, but also from a, you know, investability perspective. Is this telling you something about the health of the network, its economic value? Is this something you can actually trade against in an algo or other kind of trading strategy? You have to spend quite a bit of time, not just, you know, digging and creating metrics, but also thinking about whether it provides value, and you don't necessarily want to overwhelm, your clients. We're up to like 178 different metrics in our kind of network data product, and we could come up with hundreds if we wanted to, but at some point, you know, there's diminishing returns, and so, you know, you kind of have to balance both of those.
Yeah, definitely, it's got to make sense for the business too, right? I personally think someday on the Ethereum DApp side, there's going to be like pro subscriptions to these DApps where users will pay, you know, $5 a month for extra features, and I think part of that will be more intense data and be able to kind of dive into the DApp and like see better data. And I could see someday perhaps Coinmetrics being integrated into those solutions.
Yeah, you see that today already. Like, you know, Dharma, I think they're working with the data provider as well to better understand their own user base, right? So for a lot of these application teams or developers or kind of ecosystems or communities, you know, you can build it, but who's actually using it and what are they using it for and how are they using it, right? And so I think you'll see that a lot more and more, and you'll definitely see companies fill that niche. I mean, I think we're a little bit broader and we're approaching it more from an institutional perspective and both on the network and market data side. So whether we start to get that deep will, you know, somewhat depend on demand, but you're seeing that already. And I think to your point, that trend's only going to continue.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree. I guess one last question on the Ethereum side. I assume that you guys are pretty interested in the architectural changes in ETH 2.0 and mainly kind of the introduction of 1024 different shards, because, you know, we didn't talk much about the infrastructure you're running, but I know you're running multiple nodes, archival nodes, and you're obviously pulling data pretty heavily from those. Have you, I guess, first thought about the changes and how it's going to impact you? And then have you reached out to the ETH 2.0 teams at all to talk about, you know, how you're going to be impacted?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it's something that I've been spending a lot of time thinking about and doing some kind of reconnaissance on. I've spoken with some of the guys from Prismatic, have, you know, reached out to the community. I haven't quite been pushing as hard as, you know, I probably could, just because, you know, phase zero is probably not going to come until the beginning of next year, it seems like. So the need to kind of figure out from an infrastructure provider what that would look like is not so pressing at the moment. But yeah, with 1024 shards, it's possible that we would have to run, you know, 1024 different nodes, you know, one on each shard. And then for us, because, you know, we are offering kind of professional grade infrastructure, we typically would run two or three. So, you know, we need to run everything in triplicate. That means potentially 3,000 different nodes. But there are concepts and, you know, talk of like a super node that could validate, you know, all of, across all shards, for example. And so I think it's quite early for that. From our perspective, you know, we just want to kind of put this out there and make sure that, you know, as these kind of sharded systems are being developed, that their developers are thinking about infrastructure providers. So not just data providers like us, but, you know, if you're an exchange, if you're a custodian, if you're Etherscan, you know, all these different infrastructure providers will have to run some certain set of nodes. Some of them maybe can live on a single shard, but some of them might need to validate and audit the chain across shards. And it raises important questions of just, you know, as these systems do become more complex, are we going to lose some of that auditability? Are we going to lose that ability to fully audit the supplies of these chains, which is obviously not something that we want to do. And it's not something I'm suggesting with Ethereum, but it's something that, you know, we do need to think more about, because it's obviously important from, you know, both an economic and just a general, you know, security and all these other perspectives.
Yeah, a perspective I can add on that is going forward, and I think the first battle or big battle in crypto and blockchains was scaling. And I think we're seeing right now only the fruits of it. And one of these trade-offs of scaling is, well, you can't really see everything on chain. So you have the base chain for Bitcoin and you have second layers like Lightning Network. And you don't see what is happening. And I think that's fine. We have to basically to live with it. If we want these assets to be widely accepted and widely used, there's basically two ways. Either they get centralized and there's a finite set of custodians, and the end result is, unless you pay them a lot of money, you don't get access to the data. And the other end is you have decentralized second layer or third layer solutions. And in the end, it's still the same. You don't see all the data. So we, data providers like us, we have to adapt. And I think we find there's a lot of assets for which already we don't have all the data. But on Monero, you don't have the exact transaction volume activity. For Green, for example, you have basically nothing. But you can still learn a lot of insights. And I think we'll force at least insight data providers to get much smarter about how they compute the data. For example, for ERC20, as it is, that there's not a lot of noise happening with the transaction volume, so it is easy to get all the data. But then if it's easy, it's not really valuable, is it? So I think this is interesting to see how it will pan out. I'm not really deep into the Ethereum 2.0 because it's still not finalized yet. There's still a lot of changes that could happen between now and when it gets finally deployed. But it is something which is shared is we, either if we're still able to get a full holistic view of the network, it will be quite expensive, or we will have to sacrifice some holistic view for just a more sane services bill. This is something I've come to accept, that right now, I think it's the golden age. You have access to everything. But in the future, with Lightning Network taking off, shards, and custodians taking off, because right now it is quite dark, quite small, but the day where I will be able to send someone Bitcoin or Ethereum off-chain in a custodial way or non-custodial way, they're getting closer and closer, and we will lose, like the blockchain observers, will lose this information. I think it is for the greater good, so I'm accepted. I've not resigned myself, but I've accepted the fate.
Yeah, and it brings up really interesting questions about, like, one of the main kind of things that we focus on and that I think about a lot is the auditability of supply. And with privacy chains as one example, brings up this fundamental tension or question about whether, you know, these base layers really should be private or not. And, you know, Bitcoin isn't, it probably won't be anytime soon. Ethereum isn't, but, you know, it's possible that it may be someday, but it raises a really important question about whether you should, because I think this happened on Zcash recently or something where there was, some kind of a bug, and I'm sure Antoine can go into more detail with that. But if you can't audit the supply, you could have, you know, really dangerous inflation bugs. You could have, lost or kind of minted supply coming out of nowhere that can really affect, the trust in the network. It can really affect the investability and just the overall trust in these software currencies as being currencies and it can erode their store of value and kind of other potentials. And so that's something we think a lot about. And even today for some of the non-private chains, Antoine can speak to this, but, you know, Tron, for example, and others, the ability to audit the chain is extremely complicated. And that's kind of a problem because, you know, ultimately, if you don't know how many units are outstanding or on the ledger, you know, how do you know what people have and what people own? And you'll see instances on certain ledgers where supply will just appear in someone's wallet and you'll actually have no idea and no traceability of where that, where that supply came from. And it, you know, opens up a lot of potential questions. And yeah, maybe I'll hand it back to Antoine and see if he wants to dig in on some of that.
Yeah. So the first thing when I try to add an asset to our network data product is audit the supply, because if you know that what the supply is and you have done your accounting and you've got everything, you know that unless there's a mistake that perfectly cancels itself, that you've done it right. So for Bitcoin and all the UTXO chain, this is quite trivial. You just take the UTXO set and you dump the data. In Bitcoin Gold, there's an endpoint to do that. For Ethereum, it is quite complicated. It is not as simple as you would think. There's no endpoint anywhere in the Web3 standard or anywhere else that, hey, give me the supply of Ether, because it is quite complicated to track, to keep track of. And I would go in more details saying that, you know, the UTXO model forces protocol designers to be quite conscious about where the supply is, because it must be in the coins. So you see these proof of stake and voting and all the stuff that account-based chains do, done a bit more awkwardly in UTXO chains, but at least it makes it quite auditable. On the other hand, account-based chains, which are much more flexible to the protocol level designer, make it for the blockchain observer much more difficult to audit. For example, for Ethereum, you have to know the reward schedule and when each chain to what value. It's not specifying in the block how much Ether did the miner get, or what was the how many Ether did the uncle that was in this block got as well. There's the DAO hard fork that you have to also get information about. So you cannot audit Ethereum without having some external data, or at least the node software. So without running a node, you cannot audit Ethereum without having this data. And then you get into other assets, which are even more complex. Like EOS, I think it's doable, but you need an archive node, which just running a normal node is hard enough. So running an archive one is much more complicated. Then you have Tron, which has, I mean, I've looked into it, and there's so many ways money can move in the system. Basically, the auditability of a crypto asset boils down to how many ways can the money move, and can I see, have a trace or an event log or anything about when did this money move? For Bitcoin, it's whenever an output is created. For Ethereum, it's whenever a call is made and a mined block is mined, and as well the DAO hard fork. These are the three ways. But for Tron, there's many, many different ways. And then for Binance chain, which has a DEX inside the blockchain, I can create a transaction, which is an order. 3 days later, my order gets canceled and I get charged fees 3 days later, which is extremely complicated to keep track of. That's why we don't have all the metrics that we could for Binance chain, because it's just too complex. And as well, the code is closed source, so it makes it near impossible to keep track of everything. You have basically to replicate the node or to customize the node to give him the opportunity to report back to you and say, this is what the supply I'm seeing right now.
Yeah, and it's funny because you don't hear this, like nobody talks about this, right? You know, everyone argues about usage and their favorite coin, and but nobody talks about the auditability of supply and how, you know, on some chains like Ethereum, yes, it's difficult, but it's doable. But some chains are almost not doable in the sense of, like Antoine mentioned, you know, some chains you actually have to basically reconstruct the entire history of the chain. You have to count for every fee, every potential call, every, you know, if there's a DEX, you have to account for the kind of movements within the DEX and after to reconstruct the state of the chain, or at least the balances in each individual account. And yeah, I don't hear anybody talking about that. So I just find it fascinating.
And it's not like it's a concern for like tinfoil hats. It did happen many times in many different assets that the supply was not what people thought it was. And CoinMetrics found two instances of that in just, you know, a few months that we've been alive. The first one was Bitcoin Private, which was a reverse merge fork. I don't know what to describe it. Basically, you take Zclassic, which is a fork of the code of Zcash, and then you import all of Bitcoin's UTXO set, the Bitcoin ledger. And what happened is nobody verified that the import of the Bitcoin ledger was done correctly, and hint, it wasn't. There was many more units imported than there were outstanding in Bitcoin, but it took, I think we were the first to see it, apart from the people that did it in the first place. And it's insane that an asset at some point, I think it had a market cap of several hundred million dollars, and nobody was listed on major exchanges as well, and nobody saw that. And the other one, which is much more subtle, but it's still important to highlight, is Ripple. So Ripple, the company, has the majority of the supply of XRP, the currency. They have escrowed it, so that way it means that they cannot access it unless time passes. And every month they unlock some amount of Ripple and lock it back. But there was no clear documentation about the clear exact process. And if you were to believe and trust their reports, and what they were reporting, you would actually believe there was more Ripple in escrow than there actually were. In the end, a lot of what we do, and one of my favorite crypto sentences, do not trust. You have to verify what is happening, because otherwise there's no way to know you're not getting scammed. Unless someone has audited the Tron supply, how do you know there's not someone creating Tron out of thin air? An example was in Stellar in 2017. Someone created, I think, 20 billion Stellars, lumens, out of thin air. And it was caught quite late by the Stellar Foundation, which fixed the bug, burned some of the supply, but it didn't report about it too much. I think Messari found it again a few months back and wrote about it. But these things do happen regularly across assets that are quite big, like Stellar. And you have to either do it yourself, which is not easy, or have someone to do it that you can trust. Otherwise, you don't know what you're using.
Yeah, that's extremely interesting. I mean, to like the end user like myself, a supply number looks very easy, right? But on the back end, it's actually extremely complex. And it's cool that you guys are kind of doing the auditability yourself to catch these unique instances where supply is being created out of thin air.
Well, and we're only catching so many of them, right? And there's only so many coin metrics and there's just thousands of assets, right? I mean, not all of them have necessarily a large market cap, and not all of them are necessarily, you know, economically important, but it just speaks to the complexity of this space overall and some of the challenges. And, you know, I do think that there will be a rise of, you know, blockchain data scientists or blockchain data engineers as this asset class continues to grow. It's kind of like what you're seeing happening in traditional finance, right? Goldman Sachs, I think, has now more engineers than they do folks with a financial background. And I think as this asset class matures and takes off, if it does become, you know, an alternative economy or that can really rival the current economy, or if it does become this large, you know, alternative or one day primary financial asset class, you're going to see the rise of and the necessity to have individuals, you know, like Antoine and other data engineers and data scientists who, you know, do nothing but audit these ledgers, which is a good thing, by the way.
Yeah, something I'm seeing happening right now is, you know, crypto assets have been out for 10 years, and in 5 years since they've been really active, and we're seeing more and more complex assets come out of existence, like proof of stake protocols and many other things. But something that protocol designers should take much more care about is, how do I design my system in a way that an external observer can recreate the history of events in a way that they can audit the supply and most of the rules of the asset. And this is things that new protocols are not always taking into account and then making our job much more complex. Like one good example is Binance Chain, which was not designed with auditability in mind. But at the same time, we're seeing assets which are going the other way, either by removing the information completely, like Green, which is very easily auditable because, well, one is that the token, the supply is very simple to compute. How many minutes elapsed since the genesis of Green? That's how many Greens there should be in existence. And also because there's no way to check what is happening because all the amounts are shielded. So it does have a cost, which is there might be a fatal flaw in a crypto that means that someone is minting money. But I trust that in the end, it would show, I mean, it is like having a Damocles sword sort of above your head. You don't know whether it's going to fall, if it's going to fall. But at least it makes it just gets rid of the problem. And other ones that are saying, I gave a look recently at the Libra protocol. I think EOS might be on that end as well. They make it quite easy to edit. The issue with EOS is that there's too much data. And maybe the software is not well optimized, but running an EOS node is just an archive EOS node. There's not a lot of people doing it, so there's not a lot of documentation. The code is quite old, and also you need quite a massive server. So something, yeah, auditability needs to be a bigger item on the protocol designers, because otherwise, how do you know? At some point, I hope that we'll see people say, I'm not going to buy X because I don't know what is happening on that chain.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it sounds like a never-ending set of kind of interesting problems for you guys to solve, which I guess keeps the days interesting at a minimum, that's for sure. So this has been a great conversation. I've really enjoyed it. And I think, you know, we could talk about this for hours, and someday we should definitely have a follow-up episode to kind of recap stuff we've talked about here. But for now, what's the best way for people to kind of, you know, stay in touch with your team? I know you do some frequent blog posts. Like, what should people be subscribing to? Are there chat rooms people should join to kind of just kind of keep up with what CoinMetrics is doing?
Yeah, this has been a lot of fun. And yeah, to anyone listening, you can follow us at coinmetrics.io. We have a weekly newsletter that's open and free to anyone called, we call it the State of the Network. You can subscribe at coinmetrics.substack.com. You know, we also have a Twitter account that has quite a large following, and then each of us individually are also on Twitter. But I think the best place is probably through the website or through the newsletter. And then you mentioned our blogs. You know, we covered both the Bitcoin private and the Ripple kind of ledger report as well. We'll also be probably covering some of what Antoine mentioned on Libra. So we are actually running a node on the Libra testnet, and in our next newsletter we plan, which is every Tuesday. So next week's newsletter, which might, depending on when this gets published, it might already be released, but we plan to cover, you know, just some findings off of the testnet. So I think that would be really interesting.
Cool. Well, I definitely suggest anybody listening to go subscribe to all that content and definitely check out the site too. It's one of my favorite out there. Definitely my favorite on the data side, that's for sure. So keep up the good work, guys, and I appreciate you joining the podcast.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to the Into the Ether podcast.